Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. I hope you're doing all right, sheltering in place. Things are obviously just going completely nuts in the whole world. I hope you're staying sane, keeping it together. I have to say I feel very lucky and simultaneously like my brain is a scrambled egg. Just 24 hours of a day of feeling unusual, yet also feeling lucky and really just going about my business, working on a radio show, interviewing people, doing my work. My kid is, you know, doing school. My wife works at home anyway, so we're just going for a lot of walks around the block and watching too many movies. So, anyways, hope you're okay. You may have heard that Adam Schlesinger of Fountains of Wayne passed away. I will be posting another podcast, a tribute to Adam from when he and the band was live on my show. But during today's program, here we are, April 4th, Jerry Jamont was my guest, and I also played a bunch of Adam Schlesinger-related songs and a whole bunch of Jerry Jamont-related tunes. There was interesting, because of everyone's at home, there was an uncommon amount of comments on the playlist for today's program about Jerry Jamont and his work and our chat together. So you might want to head to WFMU.org/Michael and check out the playlist for today's show. Just interesting to hear what listeners had to say about those recordings. We're hearing one now, Freddie King's 69 version of Hideaway in the background, featuring Jerry Jamont. He just played on some amazing records, and the bass on all of them is shining. It's just incredible. So I'll get to it now. Hope you're well. I don't have any other interviews planned, but, you know, keep your ears peeled. I'll come up with something, especially if this lasts too much longer. That's it. Stay in touch. Let me know what's going on, and be safe, be healthy, and that's it. Here's me and Jerry Jamont.
Thank you. Today's special is Memphis Soul Stew. We sell so much of this, they're gonna make some Frisco hot stew. Give me about a half a teacup of bass. That's our bass player from Macon, Georgia, Gerald Jamont. And now we need a pound of fat back drums. Bernard Purdy, ladies and gentlemen, on the drums. Four level tablespoons of ball and Memphis guitar now. Carnell Dupree from Fort Worth, Texas on the guitar.
So there is Jerry Jamont on the bass there, as King Curtis called out his name there. Now, I read somewhere, Jerry, good morning, I read that you were born in the Bronx. Is that correct?
That is correct.
But in that version of Memphis Soul Stew, King Curtis says you're from Macon, Georgia. Were you? What's that about?
Well, I came up in the late 50s playing professionally, and in the early 60s I switched to electric bass. I played with some guys with the Coasters. We enjoyed playing with each other, and they couldn't believe I was from New York. So after a while, I make up names and, you know, play some from here and from there. And King Curtis knew them also. So apparently he got that in the vibe, talking to them about me, and he kept it in his memory. And all of a sudden, 4 years after I started working with him in 1971, he announces me on stage is from Macon, Georgia, which blew my mind also. I had to think back, where did he get that from? Then I realized it was from the Coasters.
Oh, that's pretty
funny. So that's how my domicile got confused.
That's interesting. So you are a local guy from the Bronx. So tell me how you started playing bass. Why the bass, and who put one in your hands?
This is a very provocative question. I've never been asked that question before. But why the bass? As a child, I had a lot of problems coming up through life. I had a lot of head injuries. And finally, I was hit by a car at the age of 9, hospitalized for 2 weeks. And after that, everything sounded differently. When I came home, the music I heard before, particularly Miles Davis' Round Midnight album, the bass stood out. And I began to focus on what Paul Chambers was playing. I said, for the first time in my life, I actually wanted to do something. And prior to that, with all the head injuries, I didn't want to do nothing. You eat, sleep, you're depressed, paranoid, you panic attacks. That was my childhood. And so I was very reclusive. So as a result, I stayed indoors a lot. I didn't do much. And when I did go outside, I would usually getting banged up in my head some kind of way. So I didn't want to do too much. I had no vision in life as a kid coming up. I never wanted to do anything. So when I declared that I wanted to do that, play the bass, my mother said, great, he wants to do something finally. And she got me a bass a year later when I entered junior high school.
Just go back. You had a head injuries, and then they sort of culminated in a car accident. What were these other head injuries from?
Well, sliding, falling down at the age of 3, I was piggybacking somebody in the basement, on the basement stairs, and fell over. I was knocked unconscious. So that was the first recorded record of my head injuries. And then I had another one a couple of years later that I remember, but because I remember the first one, I didn't tell anybody. But at the same time, I was walking into poles, my sister would tell me I would walk into, she would take me to kindergarten, and she told me how I would walk into a pole, I walked into a pole that I should have seen. And I didn't remember that, okay? But I do remember a pole on my way to elementary school when I went to private school, and when I later went to high school, that I would walk into continuously. Twice I walked into that pole, and finally when I got to high school at one point, they moved the pole, removed for some reason. So I was quite relieved, but I had a history of being walking into poles, getting hit by swings.
Wow.
This crazy stuff with the head injuries. And this is like, I have friends who've had them, and they tell me that once you get one, you get another one and another one. And you really don't talk about them. I never really talked about them until I started writing my memoirs 3 years ago. And that's when I started recounting all the stuff I went through as a child. I didn't even count that as why I played the bass or anything. That's just what happens when you just live and things happen.
How unusual. So you, after this car accident, you started hearing music differently. Two questions. One is, was there any other differences in your metaphysical self that happened due to this car accident? And did you ever talk to a doctor and figure out what actually happened inside your body that changed?
Well, when you have several concussions, you have loss of focus, loss of memory. I also had a physical bursitis. Basically, the fear, insecurity, all these things happen. Sometimes they last longer, and they get. I would have tension headaches all the time. I've been going to see Dr. Schumacher before I went to junior high school. I would constantly be going down on the west side of New York, of the Bronx, to this doctor. I ended up going to junior high school right around the corner. So I was familiar with the neighborhood, ironically, but it impeded my ability to focus and to remember things. And I also, it might have affected my hearing, because I never could really hear out of my left ear. So playing the bass was something I could see myself doing, because it satisfied my insecurity being in the background, for one thing. You could hardly hear the bass back in that way, so I wasn't out front under the microscope, so I felt comfortable playing that instrument, and I liked the way it functioned, the way it made the music move, and the way that everything that the bass did affected everything else that everybody else was doing immediately, and there was only one in the band. So these things appealed to my emotional state as a child, and I said, I want to do that. I've had a vision of myself playing the bass on stage somewhere. And I had to wait a year to get a bass at that particular point. But during that year, I listened to jazz radio constantly at that particular point. Instead of getting a bass for my birthday when I was 10, I got a tape recorder. So I record I would record all the music that I heard on the radio. So I had like a vast tape collection of Carmen McRae, Aretha Franklin when she started in Columbia. I had everything, Big Bands, Maynard Ferguson, everything they played on the radio, I was recording.
Luckily, your mom said, yes, great idea. Just to clarify, you were playing bass, I guess, in an orchestra in junior high and high school, and you learned to read music through that process?
Exactly. That's where I encountered it. She wouldn't have it any other way. She said, no, you have to wait. You're going to have a teacher, and you're going to have learn how to read. My mother insisted upon that. And I had to wait a year until she was able to, you know, afford to get me a bass and a teacher.
So we're talking about the, I guess it would be the late 1950s, very early 1960s for you.
It would be 1957.
So it's very interesting to me because the style of bass, and we've heard earlier today some examples of your playing, it's very stylized and it's very groovy, it's very funky, it's very, very interesting, and it's very sometimes bass forward, you know, pushing the whole song or the hook to the whole, but in 1958 or whatever, there was no, that didn't exist. So tell me how you went from the guy in the back of the orchestra to that guy, you know, playing on all these records we know. How did that style develop?
Well, it's the engineer's fault, the producer's fault. They pushed it up. My intention was for the bass to be felt as opposed to heard. Mm. I also loved the bass so much that I wanted to be prominent in terms of it could be diverse, it could do more than what I was hearing. So, but in my mind, even to this day, I expect it to be, I play with the intention, if I'm creating a part, it's going to be subdued in the background. But they felt otherwise, and they started pushing it up front. So that's how that happened. It's, you know, it's not in my makeup to be out front, but I do like the role of the bass and what the bass does, and being responsible, I have to play the pickups and the leaders and fills that make music interesting.
Yeah, so don't blame you. You just came up with these memorable parts and people...
Well, and again, I was, like, impaired, so I could have a limitation on my ability. It was more or less I was passion-driven. I wasn't a virtuoso, and I grew up around virtuosos, so I knew the difference from day one. When I started playing, I started professionally at the age of 12. The guys in the band, in the Newport Youth Band, we were intermingled, and I saw that the different level of musicianship was like, you know, you can't compare it. And even when I was in the Allbirds Orchestra, although it's a principal basis, I still knew that the level of ability that I had was based upon my being able to read and play technically. In terms of hearing music and improvising it, that was a challenge for me. And so I had to basically learn to develop that over a long period of time. But fortunately, I was working like 3 or 4 nights a week, and that's the best way to practice. So I got it together, you know, starting with junior high school in the 8th grade.
How fascinating. So tell me 2 things. One, tell me about the switch from the big acoustic bass to an electric bass. When and how did that happen? And then tell me about what those early gigs were. Is it, you know, we're still talking about the very early 60s or very late 50s.
Well, when I picked up the pork chop, which is what jazz players play, called the electric bass, first time I picked one up, I couldn't stand the sound of it. And this was like a 60, 61, and I swore I'd never play one. But then in 64, 63, I had a gig in Bermuda, and at the same time I was playing with other bands, I noticed that the other bands playing the electric instruments had more fun, and the band I had been playing with, were very disrespectful. They wanted to play jazz all the time and act like Miles Davis, his persona, not caring about the audience. So that kind of pissed me off. It was a tipping point for me to just do something else and be around a different set of people. So, which eventually that happened. And I didn't even get a call to play upright bass for a whole year until the next New Year's Eve. And I was already booked playing the electric bass. So that's how I made the transition.
Go back 1 second to, I mean, I think you're, if I'm doing the math right, you're still a teenager. So you're a guy living up in the Bronx, and how do you get a gig in Bermuda?
Well, you know, it's like you get, you work with musicians, and it was Gandy Burgess was the trumpet player who I worked with frequently as a sideman, and sometimes he was a leader on gigs. But these gigs would consist of playing at a ballroom, usually at a society ball. We play from like 4 o'clock to 9 o'clock to 4 o'clock, in and out between five or six other bands. So I had a chance to be around a lot of different musicians playing different styles of music from the very get-go. I was in one of the bands that played everybody's music. It was like the variety band, as opposed to being the specialty calypso band, or the Latin band, or the jazz band, or the blues band, or the rhythm and blues band, or the featured vocalist band. You'd have all these different bands on one night. It's like a festival, basically. And people would be bringing their own drinks and bottles of whiskey, and they buy the setup from the bar, from the ballroom. They bring their own food, and they'd be partying like from 9 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the morning.
That's how
you get a gig in Bermuda.
It sounds fun. For a kid with such trouble as a little kid, and then, you know, to go into this totally different culture, to travel, to get to do all these things, maybe at some point as a kid you didn't know what you were going to do, and now here you are traveling around the world, where, you know, but still a teenager. Was your mind blown?
I felt alive for the first time in my life. I had no childhood. I mean, I lived in fear, but I still had the same tendencies to be in isolation. I liked the idea of being a recording musician, for one thing. I found that out playing in a band when I was 14 called the Mixed Birds. And one of the guys in the band was named Richard Dubin. He was an older kid, white kid from upstate New York. The Yonkers, and I shouldn't say upstate. And when they had the All Bronx High School, Junior High School Orchestra auditions, they allowed other people to come in from the neighboring counties or boroughs because there was a lack of musicians available to play the music of these large orchestral works. They required 120 pieces sometimes to get the sound. And so they had people auditioning from all over. So that's where I met Richard Dubin when I was 12. And then I met him later in the Mixed Birds. He's older now. And he's coming back with this Mixed Birds rehearsals with all these stories of him going to Birdland and the Five Spot. And all the other local jazz clubs, he's hanging out with all these famous musicians and telling about how their lives are, how they go from studio to studio making records and films, commercials. And I say, wow, I want to do that. So I got the bug then. So it was all like timing, having a vision, a passion to do this, and not really knowing how it's going to turn out, you know. Life would happen. I would end up having a kid, and I was, you know, kind of cut my musical career off. I took a day job, but I still played. I would do sessions at night, and everything just kind of worked out. Basically, one thing led to another. I became known, and Ken Curtis called me and took me out on the road and promised me recording sessions.
So you had a kid, and you scaled back the music, but. That's the time when King Curtis found you, I think it's around 1966, 67. So you're still a relatively very young man, but you've started a family. So tell me where he saw you and how he knew you were the guy for him.
I remember meeting him and hearing him at Smalls. And I was playing downstairs, and he was playing upstairs, naturally. I know he definitely approached me during one night when I was playing downstairs with Frankie Downbeat Brown at a society event. We were the only band. We came with the book. They booked the hall downstairs, and the band came with the hall. So I had a regular gig there, basically. And so that's when I met him, and they laid out his plan to make records and go on tour, blah, blah, blah. And I'd already been making records. I just recorded Irma Franklin during that time. We did Peace of My Heart. And I know I had recorded Nina Simone during that time period, but 2 years prior to that, in fact. So I was getting around, and so I didn't want to, you know, lose the security of the job, you know, the day job and the opportunity to make records at night. So I was hesitant about taking the gig, but I relented and took the gig, and the rest is history.
Yeah, he kept you really busy for a few years. So let's talk about some of these very specific sessions. This is always something I love to hear about. Like you mentioned Peace of My Heart by Irma Franklin. It's just an amazing recording. And after working clubs and stuff like that, I mean, do you remember those dates clearly? Was it, you know, a 3-hour session? Was it all night? Do you remember being there for Peace of My Heart?
Oh, yeah. This was in the early days, especially you know, a lot of gigs like we did leading up to these gigs, what's important to know is that, you know, coming from a jazz tradition, there's a musician's perspective. You're going to play all kinds of music, and you're going to see all kinds of things happening. You're seeing people's reaction to the music. Some of the most enjoyable performances I've had, you know, outside the studio were playing with, you know, belly dancers and playing for different magic acts, you know, different things you have to be called on to do to be in the moment, basically. Those are things that you bring into the studio with you. And sometimes you try to replicate them. What you remember, what you saw visually, what you made happen, you know, another night ago in a club, you try to do the same thing in the studio. So this is all natural. So, for instance, you've referenced Peace of My Heart. I remember that exactly. That was at the Hit Factory. And the backgrounds, everybody was there at the same time, the singers, the musicians. It all went down at one time. And they had charts. It was a well arranged. And my job was to take that arrangement and the part that was given to me and make it come to life, basically. And I looked for opportunities where I'm listening to the song and actually how to make the song come to life and through my part, if possible. If not, I just play my part and everything is cool. I wasn't trying to be a star, just do my job, basically. But do my job so that it's memorable. That's the key word, because you're making history. So you have that intention in your head when you're going into, at least I do, when I pick up the bass in the studio, I'm here to make history. So all those things I remember pretty well.
So let's talk about Nina Simone. You mentioned her. She is kind of, I don't know how to put it. She's a real live wire. She could be anyway. She had that reputation. A lot of energy there, a lot of talent, a lot of raw emotion there. What was it like working with her in the studio? I assume she's not a lady who held back on how she wanted it to sound or what she wanted out of the group.
She was astounding. I mean, she was, you know, most people in the studio, you know, are very professional and they want to get the job done. So, you know, it's very rare when somebody goes off and has to do anything outstanding and they get too emotional, basically, about something not going right, basically. She was cool. I mean, I loved her singing when I was as a child coming up, and before, you know, some of my earliest records of music when I was in my, you know, 7, 8, 9, when my sister would start bringing music into the house, was of Nina Simone. So working with her was like, you know, it was just an honor just to be there. I only did one song with her on that one album that we did. I thought she was singing just to me. You know?
Tell me about Aretha Franklin. A lot of songs that you played on for Aretha are some of the real, real classic stuff. And I know that at a certain point they were kind of flying some of the guys from Muscle Shoals up to New York. And at a certain point they were sending some of the guys from New York down to Muscle Shoals. So tell me about working with Roger Hawkins, working with those Muscle Shoals guys. And was Aretha in the room cutting the vocals live, or how did that work?
They did fly the people up from Muscle Shoals up to New York to record after the first initial, I think it was I Never Loved a Man. The first thing they tried to cut with the band in Muscle Shoals, and that when something went awry, and it's all historical fact, you know, whatever side of the story you're listening to.
Yeah, well, Rick Hall and Aretha's husband got into it, and that was the end of recording down there.
Yeah, that was it. So then they moved the session up to New York, and from that point on, they would fly the guys up, Rick Hall's guys, up from Muscle Shoals to New York to record.
So tell me about working with those Southern guys, with like Roger Hawkins, great drummer. What was it like? You just immediately lock in with him?
Well, the funny thing is, prior to that, you know, back in the 60s, Jerry Ragavoy at the Hit Factory, who co-produced Peace of My Heart with Burt Burns, him and Jerry Wexler were friends, and they would share music back and forth back in the early 60s before they signed Aretha. And he would send his music down to Rick Hall. Jerry Wexler would send the music down to Rick Hall. And he would share the music with them, with his musicians down there. And Rick Hall would tell his guys, he would say, play like this. Okay? So this was going on for a long time before Aretha got there. So understand, they had a sensibility of sophistication in playing music. And so they were prepared for Aretha when Aretha came. And so, to answer your question about playing with Roger Hawkins, he had a solid backbeat. He played much in the style of Herb Lavelle in terms of being, he could be very subdued and not stick out, but very keep solid time. He was not flamboyant, but he was a very good timekeeper. He had great sensibility about phrasing and music. He knew when to play and when not to play. And he could pick up on ideas very quickly.
Important. So you mentioned Jerry Wexler, who I guess is, for most of those Aretha tracks, is the producer. He was one of the guys who sort of started Atlantic. You know, I can't tell guys like him. His name is on so many records that he must have, his presence is the thing. But I can't tell, what does a guy like him actually contribute to a session by being the producer?
Ears. And in fact, you know, it's funny, you're asking me some great questions, Michael, that I was going to ask before. I'm really glad to be doing this interview and enlightening your audience. Producer, you know, typically I used to be the A&R man, artist and repertoire. Exactly, and it means exactly what it means, artist and the repertoire that they're going to record. And he's going to find repertoire for that particular artist that's suitable to make that artist a star. That's the premise. And so a producer has the same, basically, it's become the same kind of person, basically, or he will find a producer to actually fulfill his vision. So it's like, it's kind of a mishmash of terms, but his thing is he has to have the ability to hear about what the person is doing and what personnel needs to be around that person as a producer to supply that artist or surround that artist with the proper personnel. And then while the session's going on, to make wise and useful suggestions if necessary to make sure the music goes in the right direction and that everything is going off smoothly in terms of time, you know, budget, a lot of things that go on the producer has to deal with. So they have a multitude of sometimes the producers. Jerry Wexler was one who he said very little. He just let us play. He had very little say. He might the stories about him dancing in the studio, you know, to emulate a certain kind of feel. But on the Aretha sessions, he was he had very little to say. So, but the producer's role is very important, to have a producer, you know, to keep track of what's going on and to keep it going in the right direction.
This is kind of an impossible question, but when you record a song like Think, you know, is there any way in your head that you think, well, 50 years from now, I'm going to be talking about this, people are going to be still listening to this on the radio? Do you know the enormity of what you're taking part in?
Yes, we do. You know, at the time when that was recorded, I mean, that's funny. That's that was the predecessor to that was my first introduction to Aretha on that particular session. And I knew when I got up to leave the studio after recording was made, that was going to be a hit. There was no doubt in mind. And then Tommy Caldwell told me, "No, you stay here. Don't leave the bass chair. You keep playing for the rest of the session," because I was called down to observe the session, basically, because something was not clicking the session before. They couldn't get it done. And I was called to observe a session that started at 10 o'clock. He said, "Come down." Jerry said, "Come down. You may play, you may not play, but be prepared. You'll get paid anyway. You'll be an observer. Be prepared to play." So the session started from 10 to 1, then it was a 2 to 5. And they couldn't get past the 8-bar intro that Aretha was playing. She played this badass intro on the piano, which you all know. And after that, it just went nowhere. And for 3 hours, they kept on doing it. And usually when something like that happens in the studio, a lot of times, we'll go to another song, we'll come back to this later. You know, the first song is very important to get that first song taken care of, and everything else kind of like follows after the energy put out and the time spent, on that first song. Well, they spent the whole 3 hours on that one song. And at 2 o'clock, Jerry Wexler said, "Go in there and see what you can do." So I went in there and 2 or 3 takes, it was over. I came up with a part to play. They learned how to play, they copied my part, and they used that part 2 or 3 times during the song. It was the introduction after she plays that 8 bars. I come up with a lead in. And they learned that lead, and they use it to go to the bridge, and they use it coming out of the song. And that kind of put the song together. Plus, the groove I played was different than the groove that Tommy was playing. And they all fell into the groove, which happened to be a country western groove. And they were trying to attempt to play, making that a slick rhythm and blues groove for those 3 hours in the morning. So that kind of set up the rest of the session of my whole 48-year relationship with Aretha from that one moment on.
Ah, that's amazing. What a great story. That's just intense. That's great. What was working with Duane Allman like?
Oh, we had fun. we had a lot of fun.
Please elaborate.
He was a cool cat. King Curtis introduced him to me on a session that we did, Instant Groove. That's where I met Dwayne. He had met him. I don't know how they met. I think Delaney and Bonnie might have been involved in it. There's a whole circle there with Eric Clapton and Dwayne and Delaney and Bonnie and Ken Curtis, and they all hang out at the Fruity Hellas, a discotheque in the village in the '60s. So there's a lot of, you know, communication activity going on between musicians and producers and artists and just people who love music during that time. Lots was going on there. You had the Vietnam War, civil rights, women's rights. So the country was alive and vital, and everybody wanted to say something. And everybody wanted release also at the same time.
So were you like a party kind of guy?
Oh, no, I was not much. No, I was just like I was when I was a kid. I see the session, I go right home. I go straight home. In between sessions, I'd hang out by myself, basically. Other guys would go to a place called Jim and Andy's Club. It was called Jim and Andy's originally, then it turned to Possible 20. I would hang out there and communicate, network, basically, and get other jobs. I wasn't into that. You know, call me. You got my number. I'm on radio registry. You know, if you want me, if you need me, call me. I'm out, basically.
Well, tell me, we've had Bernard Purdy on the show. His body of work speaks for itself, and his personality is definitely larger than life. Definitely also a unique drummer. He's one of those guys, you hear him play, and you know it's him right away, usually, you know. Tell me about working with him in the studio.
Oh, it was a challenge. It was fun. It was a challenge. We had fun. We had a little competition going on. I'd have to sometimes fool him. I came up in the jazz tradition where everybody would play, you know, separate parts, basically. I had a hard time, in fact, in the studio, into locking in and settling down and playing simplified parts, for one thing. But I always had the mind that everybody should still play a separate, identifiable part that would sometimes lock or interlock, but, you know, it complement each other. But he always had a tendency to try to copy my part and emulate my part, you know, to the point where I said, okay, well, this is what you can think of doing. So I would, you know, when the red light came on to record, I'd play something else. And he'd be playing the part that I had laid down before. So we had that little thing going on. But other than that, you know, he's like you say, he's larger than life, tends to exaggerate the moment and his history and what his accomplishments. I will not get into that because it's already a public record, how I feel about that. But he was a challenge to work with. We had some great, good moments. He was on, but we went on a road together with Ken Curtis and Aretha during the 71 tour.
Right. Oh, so you mean you didn't play in any of those Beatles records with Bernard?
Did you?
No, I wasn't there that day. Yeah. So yeah,
I don't think he was either. But you know, in the studio, we had a whole stream of income. Not to, you know, anything is possible. You know, you can put yourself in a picture if you like, but during those days, I mean, even today I get called to do overdubs of taking people's bass parts off and putting my part on. So that was a whole stream of income of just doing that, doing overdub. So it's very possible that could have happened.
Oh, I'm sure Bernard fixed a lot of records. I just don't think he fixed any Beatles.
Yeah, sure. We fixed a lot of stuff. Fixed, overdub, you know, here and there. Sure.
So you mentioned this live at the Fillmore West. This is you and Bernard Purdy, Billy Preston, Cornell Dupree, and of course King Curtis. You got your own live album out of it and a live album from Aretha. And they're both pretty amazing records and some fantastic versions of some of the songs. And really, you know, that band's on fire. Every guy in that band whose name I just called is a monster. You know, so I assume being on stage was just super fun. And what was the audience like 1971 at the Fillmore West?
Oh, they were great. They were great. I mean, the time, the plan was a good plan to do that, to expose this style of music to this particular audience. It was described as young flower, children. I refer to them as, you know, young beatniks coming up from my era. They were very receptive. They were groovy. They were very, very responsive. They were all on this. They had what we call now arena seating. So the club, which I played in recently with Greg Allman, not recently, maybe about whenever, 2011, 2012, we played the Fillmore. And you stand up, it's arena seating. You're standing on your feet. You're not sitting down. Everybody was on their feet. So they were up engaged, and the show was crazy. The first act was of Tower of Power. Then we followed by the Memphis Horns. Then followed by King Curtis and the Kingpins. Then followed by the Aretha Franklin Show. So it was a four-act show on the first Friday night. Then it got scaled down to just the Memphis Horns, King Curtis, and Aretha. But that first night, I mean, and the ensuing nights, and when Ray Charles came on stage, it was just crazy. The audience was fired up. Fired up every night. Danny Glover will tell you he was there.
Do you still listen to those records yourself?
Not really. You know, I hear them every once in a while on the radio. I might see edits, clips on YouTube. Because Bill Graham would photograph or videotape, unbeknownst to the artist, using the spotlight camera to record the shows. And we didn't find this out until, like, you know, many years later. But he did this at the Fillmore East, the Fillmore West. So it's funny to hear those original recordings and actually see them happening in black and white. I might hear them then. But other than that, you know, if I catch it, if somebody sends it to me, it's always nice.
Yeah. I want to remind folks that Jerry Jamont is our guest. Jerry, what is the website that folks can sort of see your whole story and check out this book when it comes out?
JerryJamont.com. JerryJamont.com.
Tell me about, there's a track of yours, this version of For What It's Worth, Voices of East Harlem. Was that just a studio gig? You just called in there and showed up, and that's what you laid down?
That's exactly it. That was my, it's funny, it was like a dream come true for me to do that kind of work, and it still is because of some of my history of being basically a hermit or isolationist, to be able to get a call and to go work and do my thing and then disappear. I love doing that. It was like the hired gun kind of thing. Dwayne and I would embrace that idea of going from studio to studio and making these great hit records that, you know, we realized that our parts were important and that, you know, at that point, you know, I was really feeling myself and saying, yeah, I'm really making a contribution here. What I'm playing is important. In fact, it might be unorthodox, but I'm hearing it, and it's all about the bass. It's really not about me. I'm going to go for it. That particular track was like really like being like this, going crazy, I guess, at the spirit of the moment.
Yeah, you're in charge of that one. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned going from studio to studio, and this is, you know, I almost hesitate to read off a list because it'll sound like it's the whole list, but I really want to stress this is, you know, I could name names for a half hour, but some of them, Freddie King and Roberta Flack and Jerry Jeff Walker's Mr. Bojangles and B.B. King and Shirley Scott and Otis Rush and Janice Ian and Herbie Mann. And I saw that the Rascals, you did some bass because there was no bass player in the Rascals, right?
Right, right.
So
how
were those sessions? That sounds like fun.
They were great. They were produced by Arif Mardin, the same producer who called me to do the Wilson Pickett session, Deborah, when nobody showed up. Mm. He produced Rascals, and he called me to do them. It was great. He had the charts all prepared. He's very, you know, Arif had great ears. Great, he was great to work with. So I miss him dearly. Missed him for a long time. There's a whole crew down there. It's been a long time. You're talking 52 years. At this particular point, it's hard to even fathom that if I'm doing that work, then I'd even be alive 52 years later. Okay?
but people are still listening to those records. It's intense. One more, the Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Gil Scott-Heron's 1971. Again, a real bass-forward thing. Was that bass line written, or did you just come up with that over the groove?
As usual, I usually come up with, you know, create the groove as with the bass line, or I listen to more what the poet is, or the singer, or the horn player is presenting, and I form my line around what's going to make their part stand out. That's basically what I do. Mm. I don't listen to the drums. I literally focus on what the lead vocal or the poet or the horn is playing, or if it's a narration, spoken word, if somebody that's talking, am I going to play that's going to make their narration stronger. So I've been doing this since I was a kid, playing in the Greenwich Village, playing with poets and beatniks, so to speak. So I was familiar with that style of presentation, and I just, you know, you just do what you do. You know, I tell people, do what you hear. You know, if you hear it, it's what it's meant for you to hear. It's going to come through you. It's a combination of what that person is presenting and what you know and what you can bring from the cosmos to make that presentation come alive so other people will be able to enjoy it to the fullest. It is that simple. It's not that complex.
Yet everybody has their own approach to it, and a lot of it is just your
exactly.
own, your personal
exactly.
thing.
That's the beautiful thing about it.
Yeah. So, 1972, you get into a car accident. Am I right that Roberta Flack and Cornell Dupree, the guitar player, were in the car as well?
Yes. Yes.
And you guys were just going to a gig or somewhere?
No, we were coming from the airport, you know, after a gig. And I was driving, so the memory haunts me, has haunted me for up until this day, because we've all suffered tremendously. That was probably my 13th head injury. We all got bad whiplash hurt. Cornell was the hurt the most. He got hit by a suitcase that was in the back seat.
Oh.
He had to spend a lot of time for facial reconstruction and head injuries. We both, Roberta, stayed in the hospital. I walked out of the hospital. I walked out of the Metropolitan Hospital. It was a terrible accident. But we've all had to, you know, deal with it for the last 50 years.
It kind of put your career on hold for quite a few years, right?
Yes, certainly. Well, you know, it's funny. I tell in my book how I started when I was writing my book, I have to make a correction. It seemed like I just made the correction. It seemed like years before I would go back and play again in my mind, looking at it from it now. But in actuality, the shock of it was so great, I attempted to make a stand playing the following year, which is like this happened December 12th, so it's 1973. I wasn't playing. I wasn't able to play. I gave my instruments away from people to hold. And I started getting my way back into playing. And during that time, I discovered true Buddhism. I started chanting. And things started happening. And next thing you know, I got a gig with Bette Midler doing Clams on the Half Show with Lionel Hampton, who I had been playing with when I left King Curtis's band in 67. And next thing you know, I'm working with Herbie Mann again. From out of the studio. So I'm busy juggling these three gigs around for the next 3 months. And finally, I said, enough is enough. This is too hard. I ain't ready. And at that point, I stopped playing. I didn't pick the bass up again until 1976, basically. I mean, when you have whiplash, you think you are right, but we still have a general adrenaline going. When you have a car accident like that, you're able to walk and talk, but your brain is jelly, basically. You think you're right, but you ain't all right. And it took me 3 or 4 months to realize, oh no, you got to take a rest. This is not happening. You need more time off. And then when I got more time put in, I realized I'm having a hard time playing. It was like really difficult to get back on track. And fortunately, I had a friend like Richard Davis who had introduced me to chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo. And I'd asked him, you know, well, how can I get better? He said, teach. And so from that point on in 1976, I started teaching.
And I know that you still, even today, you teach, and you teach over Skype. Folks can go to your website and figure that out with you. That's such an interesting way to do it.
Certainly. Especially today's environment, everybody wants to stay home. Skype is a good solution.
It's the only way, yeah. That's very interesting. Yeah, so you did come back and you worked a lot of film work, and you worked with, like, you know, the Boston Pops, a real varied, you know, you added even a wider stuff to your resume, and made solo records and had groups and worked with Aretha some more and Greg Allman and, you know, all kinds of stuff. Your life is incredible, and I just think, like, where would Jerry Jamont be without the bass? You know, it's almost hard to imagine.
I'd be nowhere. I'd be on the bottom. I'd probably be looking down in my basement on the floor, because as a kid, I'd look out my window on the third floor and wonder if I would survive falling, jumping out the window into the basement, 4 flights down. That was my childhood.
I'm glad you'd found the bass, man. Ooh. That's tough. This is great, and really looking forward to your book. Folks can go to jerryjamont.com for information about, you know, I guess if this ever ends, where you'll be touring and just all and to see your full discography stuff, all the records that you've played on. These are great stories, and just thanks so much for visiting with us.
Well, thank you. And the book is called I'm That Guy. We haven't published it yet. I have a ghostwriter who's working with me on the book. We finished. We'll be looking for a publisher now. So if anybody has any ideas for a major publisher, that would be wonderful, because that's where, at the point we are, to get this wonderful story. And I thank you and your audience for hearing my story. And enjoy the music that's coming forth. I have a lot of things. My website represents the things I've done in the past. So I've done some new exciting things that I might have mentioned during the interview besides the book. Things are moving along. I'm making use of my time and my experience for these last 7 decades of making music on this planet. I really appreciate the time, and I hope your audience does well with the current situation that the world is facing.
What do you say we hear Think from Aretha, since you told that great story earlier?
Okay.
Let's hear Jerry Jamont, thank you so much.
Yeah, you're quite welcome, Michael, and all the best to you and the family. Stay safe.
You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back, let's go way on, way back when. I didn't even know you couldn't have been too much more than 10.